kuvekazu mushorsam ktizenketu eben aluliak samara nem ayan lot. In other words, if you are 12 years old or younger, you should be in school and not listening to this radio show.
You're not dumb enough to actually try it.
Welcome to the November 19th, 2012 edition of Mindenki Yoga. This is JD.
Interrupting all programs.
This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite. Orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Cuban army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite.
On this edition of Mindenki Yoga, we're going to talk about the Israeli assault on Gaza, Palestine. So on this edition is about the Israeli assault on Gaza, Palestine, the part of Palestine that is on the that is on the Mediterranean coast, also connecting to Egypt in the south. In the past weeks, there's been rockets coming from Gaza, as well as Israelis shooting sharpshooter shots at Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. As well, it's one of these things where it depends on which media narrative you pick as to who started it or who didn't start it. I mean, it all started in 1948, but you know, more recently, who started it? Do you want to start last week or the week before? But nonetheless, there is this is not a situation of two armies with roughly equal power. One has overwhelming force, and the other one has rockets, which are not guided missiles, but just rockets, which are very deadly if they hit your building, but really do not actually have much guidance whatsoever, as opposed to what's considered to be the fourth or fifth most powerful army in the world, which is backed by the Western powers. The United States is its number one ally and has all the best technology in the world at its disposal. And you have Gaza, the Gaza Strip, which is approximately 2 million people, or 1.5 million people, in one of the most crowded areas of the world. And that part of Palestine is under siege, considered to be by some to be under an illegal siege by under international law. This has been going on for a long time, but especially, well, 2 years ago, no, sorry, 4 years ago, we should remember, Obama was just elected, and there is an upcoming election in Israel. And the Prime Minister of Israel attacked Gaza for similar reasons. And this was often said to be in preparation for domestic election purposes, as you would say, and also had the purpose of forcing the U.S., the new U.S. president, to take sides in favor of Israel. So here we are 4 years later, a new U.S., well, not a new U.S. president, but a newly elected U.S. president, and a new new Israeli election coming up in January 2013. And it's like almost, it's like a first time tragedy, second time farce almost, as I think it was Marx that said that. So here we are, 4 years later, and it's no longer Operation Cast Lead, but this time it's Pillar of Smoke or Pillar of Cloud of Pillar or something. I don't even understand the name of the operation this time. But the important thing is that here we go again, and there's terrible situation happening in Gaza. According to the Palestine Center for Human Rights, which is a UN-funded and also funded by other Western NGOs, says that as of Sunday night, on the fifth day of the Israeli attack, there are 51 killed in Gaza, as well as 3 killed in Israel, 27 of which are civilians in total. Today there is 10 children and 5 women that were killed. 535 Palestinians have been wounded. 520 of those Palestinian civilians are 520 of those 535 are Palestinian civilians, of which 140 are children and 83 are women in total that are wounded. And a total of 10 journalists have been wounded by the Israelis, by the Israeli assault in Gaza. It also, in a larger context, the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA, came out with a report last August that said, quote, without remedial action now, Gaza's problems in water, electricity, and health will get worse. And it concluded that by the year 2020, that the Gaza Strip will be an unlivable place. This is, why is it unlivable? Because it's, everybody that lives there is trapped. There's only one way out that's not controlled by Israel, and that's the Egyptian border, which is only one border outlet. And the U.S. has basically paid Egypt to keep tight control over that. Even in this new revolutionary Egypt, this is still not an open border situation. It's not a normal border like in any other country. It's more open than it was 4 years ago, this is true, but still there is much more work to be done in order to bring civilians in and out of that border and to make it easy, just like any other country. I don't want to go into all these details because our guests are going to speak much more articulately than I can about these things. First, we're going to talk to Majed Abu Salama. Majed, I first met him. He came to Budapest a year and a half ago, maybe almost 2 years ago now. He was on a speaking tour in Europe, and he came to visit in Budapest. And, well, you'll hear a six-minute interview with him. He's obviously very emotional. He's in Gaza, and he lives in the north-central part of Gaza. I'm not sure exactly where, but you know, he can hear the bombs from where he sits in his computer, as you will hear. And it's, you know, how big is Gaza? I looked it up, and you know, Gaza is almost exactly the same size as Pest, if you can imagine that. So you can imagine, you know, 1.5 something million people living in the size of Pest, which is pretty much imaginable, but being trapped, not being able to leave. All the electricity is controlled by another country. It's a siege, a medieval siege, basically. So we're going to talk to Majed Abu Salama, and we're also going to talk to Harry Fear, who is a British journalist and activist that is in Gaza tonight. And then we're going to talk to Ofer Naiman, who is a Israeli peace activist living in Jerusalem. And then after that, we'll play some Democracy Now. But first, let's talk to Majed Abu Salama, and he is a Palestinian Gazan peace activist, And he's I met him when he was on tour here in Europe. And it's a 6-minute interview. It's very short. I you can feel his emotions as his country is being bombed. Here's Majed Abu Salama.
Majed, in Gaza, the life right now, it's really horrible. Like, lots of bombs raining everywhere in Gaza Strip. You know, like, it is horrible what's going on. It's just a new crimes that against humanity. You know, bombs are raining everywhere from the north and the east and the west and the south. And there is also the Navy, the Israeli Navy is shooting everywhere, all the houses in the beach. You know, the drones and the F-16 in the sky, and the tanks and the lands. You know, and everything is working and shooting every day in my area. Just in my area, there was about you see, this is bombing now. It's without bombing now. Yeah, this is maybe it's every 5 minutes there is about 6-5 bombs, you know. I don't know, sometimes in 1 minute there will be 10 bombs, you know, in the same 10 bomb falling around the area. So imagine that how this would work. It is like a scary life, a horrible life of people, how they live when they know that they're gonna die anytime, you know, like this Fahmi Al Fahmi, my friend Fahmi Al-Dalo, like the Al-Dalo family, they're very peaceful. I know them very well. Like, how they could kill peaceful family? Like, they're living at home, I'm sure. Like, they're just scared, like, we and our family, just cozying ourselves at home, not going outside the streets, you know. Imagine, people telling each other here is how to try and save themselves. People who have houses with lots of windows are covering the closets with sheets and blankets. You know, I mean, I'm like, all the windows are down, all the windows are open, because even if it is cold, because we don't, if there is a big bombs going on and all the big bombs around my homes, all the big rockets and missiles that Israel throwing against civilians of Gaza, it's all around my home. And it's like anytime these bombs can be, with a loud voice of it, it can explode the window on me, you know, and my family when they're sleeping, you know. And that's people in blankets to protect themselves from the glasses when it's explosion from the pressure. You know, there is something that stops the glass from spreading all over. People are also living in the middle of the rooms. You know, some people live in the bathroom, some people live in the kitchen, because this is the safest area ever. It is horrible what's going on, because we are not safe anywhere, you know. Wherever you go, you're not safe. Any bullets can come. Any bombs can come. Any missiles can come. You can be killed anytime. That is the point. It can be a crime against you and your family anytime, because Israelis are Israeli army are terrorists. Israeli army are committing crimes against Palestinians right now and every day. And it's very sad. It's very sad how a human kill a human. But it's we know it's not equal. It's an occupation. It's an occupation, continuous occupation, and continuous colonizing against Palestinian. This is ethnic colonizing against Palestinian. We cannot go outside a lot. We cannot go at all, even outside. When we go at all, we go to supermarket. We open it very slowly. We can get some rice and some food to eat, you know. We don't have. We cannot leave the house on Friday, even when Friday is a holiday. Like, people were scared to go to pray in the mosque, because if you could just go and walk in the street, maybe they will bomb you and bomb the group. Lots of groups were just standing in front of their home and they bombed them. Imagine the amounts of injured people. There are about 630 people, more than 630 people. More than half of them are children. More than 300 are children. They're less than 15 years old. And this massacre continues with women and elderly. They are killing civilians. They're killing people. They're bombing in houses. We are crowded populations in Gaza Strip. In my refugee camp, there is 280,000 people. Whenever bomb will be dropped, and all the bombs here in north of Gaza in my refugee camp, this is like, it just bombed in any civilian's house. They have technology. They could see who is terrorist or who is not, but they are just killing for killing. Like, we go to the market a little bit when we're scared, you know. We go to the market when we are, we're lucky that we have the market close to us, you know. When we feel the time, it's good to go to the market, we can go. You know, they are just, like, You cannot, even in your office, you are not, like my yesterday, my journalist friend, they were in their office on the channel, and they bombed the office. They want to stop the media. They want to stop the voice of journalists to go outside. My friend, he lost his leg yesterday. He lost his leg. My father, my other friend, 3 days ago, he just died when he was walking, visiting his wife. He's 52 years old. He's an old man. Why you kill an old man? What the Inabim baby kid did for this Israelis to kill her. Like, what did, I cannot understand what this, for months, what this 5 years baby kid did for the Israelis. More than half of the people who were killed, 63 persons were killed in these 3 days of attacks. 63, more than half of them are children and women.
You recently took a tour of Europe, and you met many people in Europe. I mean, have you been in contact with them? Do you have a message for them?
I have a message to all the protesters in all the streets, all the Occupy movements. They have to stand up. Everybody, all the human rights organization. We don't count on government. We count on community. We count on people. There is politics going on around. Like, there is. It's just as scary. Like, when I'm talking to you, and just a bullet can go and a bomb can go. It's like any, it can, it's very scary life that we live here. It's a traumatizing. It's terrifying everybody here. It's scaring everybody. Guess yourself that you are in this situation. We don't count on government. If government will talk, they will talk. But protesters in the streets can talk. Occupy movement can talk. People in the Arab Springs talks one time and they change system. And we count some people in Europe and USA and Canada to change Anton Obama. If he just can cry for his, he cannot cry for his children. He cried to get an election done. But he cannot cry for Palestinians. He gave $4 billion to the Israelis to get weapons to kill Palestinians. All this weapons and rockets that thrown to Palestinians in Gaza on civilians that are made in USA. I'm telling to German people to stop their governments of kill it, to stop the government of giving to the Israeli Navy the war boats, which like made our life yesterday hell. It's hell in Gaza. It's a massacre in Gaza. And all these boats yesterday of the German were killing Palestinians in the sea, were shooting in all the houses when people inside the house. Isn't that something to stand up for? Don't you think that now it's time for more action? It's time to let all the universities to stop in Europe. Where is the Students' Council? Where is the Students' Council, the European Parliament for Youth? Where is young people of Europe? Are they just ignorant? Are they just don't care? Are they just care about tourism and themselves? Woke up, there is a humanity here. There is people are killed in Gaza through humans. It's a massacre committed. It's an international crime. It's a human rights. Can anybody be in it? You're lucky that you just was born in Europe. But we have a cause here. We have a justice cause, like the South African cause. Like every, like all occupation schools. Just come back to the French Revolution. Come back to the to the American Civil War when people were killed. Did you guess yourself? You are under. You can be killed anytime in the streets, in your house, when you're eating, you're praying, when you anything. You cannot do anything. You cannot do anything for your human rights. 7 years we are under the blockade. 7 years we are under the blockade. Lots of people lose their scholarship. We are sitting in checkpoints and under settlement. Border of Israeli people, Israeli army, are just attacking us. We're happy that some peace activists of Israeli peace activist friends of mine are in the streets of Tel Aviv right now. And 50 protesters and demonstrations are going on in 50 cities. But still, 50 cities is not enough in all this world. We are a lot in this world. There are more than 200 countries. Where are they? Why they don't stand up right now? Every minute, my house is shaking. It's rocked with bombs. With drains, with everything. The attacks did not stop till now. We just need everybody to stand up.
Mujahid, thank you very much. Do you have any last thoughts before we close this interview?
My last message is as a call for the Hungarian people and the political parties in all Europe. It's a call for all young people and students, parties, in universities, that they have to stand up. They have to call for justice. It's your cause. It's a justice cause. Everybody, like, where there is a crime, where is the crime against humanity, there has to be your justice. Now it's our time to stand up with us. We're in Gaza, need your help, need your stand, need your voice. Please, like, follow us with all the, we need your social media revolution to stand up. We're spreading the news. We're trying to break the mainstream media. The mainstream media is not giving you the real news about what's going on in Gaza. So please follow us. Follow my Twitter, Majid Abu Salama. Follow my Facebook. Follow my our websites in Gaza, in Palestine. Look at the truth. Look at the truth yourself and judge yourself. Be involved and don't stay at home without standing up for humanity and for justice and peace in the world. It's a call for young people everywhere to stand up, young people and Palestine and European and Americans and everybody to stand up. I wish this voice can go on, and thanks for the solidarity movements in Hungary and everybody there.
Thank you, Majed. Thank you, Majed Abu Salama. Thank you, and stay safe in Gaza tonight.
That was Majed Abu Salama. As you can tell from him, he's very emotional and very kind of, you know, it's a very hard situation for him. Obviously, bombs are dropping in his neighborhood, in his home, in his country, in his city. At the time that we were doing this, shortly after did the interview, he disconnected and the electricity went out in his part of Gaza, which is a very common thing anyways in Gaza, but is especially common during wartime. Okay, so next we're going to talk to Harry Fear, and Harry is he's a British man, and he's been living in Gaza for a little while. He'll explain how long he's been there, and he's there as a citizen activist, much like Majed Abu Salama, but he's British. And he's been doing this Ustream thing where he's like doing live video, giving reports live on the internet as he gets them while he's in Gaza. And I'll put the links to Harry Fear's website and his live stream or Ustream, and you can watch him yourself. So you can find that at lmv.hu/mindenkioga, MINDENKIJOGA. So yeah, here's Harry Fear.
Thank you, Harry Fear, for coming onto the Mindenki Yoga radio show. Please introduce yourself and where are you right now?
Well, my name is Harry Fear. I'm a documentary filmmaker, journalist, and campaigner for Palestinian rights. And I am on day 5 of Operation Pillar of Cloud in West Gaza City, in the north area of the Gaza Strip, here in the Middle East.
In the north area, I was watching the Al Jazeera tonight, and they were saying that this was being hit pretty hard in this area.
Yeah, north of this position is being hit hard. We have the north bit of the strip. At the bottom of it is Gaza City, where I am, to the west of, just by the Mediterranean Sea, by the coast. Then we have the middle area containing, for example, the Nusayrat refugee camp. And then between the middle area and the southern area, we have Khan Yunis, which is also struck and is one of the kind of usual suspects of being struck. Then in the southern area, we have Rafah, which is also another usual suspect of being struck.
Now, the Israelis say that they have deoccupied Gaza for many years now. Can you explain why that's not exactly true?
Yes, under international law, Israel still has an occupying responsibility towards the people of Gaza. They're about 1.5 to 1.7 million in number. Most of them are technically refugees. Most of them are also under the age of 18. And most of them rely on food agencies just to survive so they do not starve to death. Now, Israel controls the maritime territorial waters of Palestine. It also totally dominates the airspace. So two of the three dimensions, if you will, are automatically 100% controlled by Israel. Then looking at the land situation, there's a border with Egypt as well as Israel. But Israel has really such a high level of dominance of almost every aspect of Gazans' lives that under international law and according to the United Nations, Israel actually is an occupying power with respect to Gaza.
They control the air, and they control the how far fishermen can go out to sea. They're not allowed to go into Israel through their own borders, and they just have and I guess now the Egyptians have opened up a border, but it's still not very much. What kind of medical aid, for example, can Gazans get?
Well, the medical aid will be incoming in the next few days. We're now in day 5 of the operation of the war, but we haven't actually seen any medical aid being supplied yet by any convoys or any states, but that has been promised by some states, so we'll hope that that materializes. But at the moment, the medical reserves, that the medicine supplies, are basically about to be wiped out. So the situation is grave in that respect with medical aid. The Palestinian hospitals here are so weak as it is normally that when this sort of thing happens, when you're getting 600 injured people, 230 of them are children, you can just imagine the kind of overburdening that's occurring here.
How are you living there? What is your situation? What keeps you safe? I hope you're safe.
I'm staying in one of the safest areas in Gaza, in an area where internationals live. It's one of the safest, but it's not absolutely safe. It's relatively safe because nowhere is safe in Gaza, really. During the last major operation on Gaza during winter 2008-09, Israel actually shelled, blasted from the water the building just next door to this one. So there's a precedent for Israel attacking this area, which is full of internationals, particularly journalists and aid workers. So nowhere is safe according to the historical record. But although we've heard various, probably now dozens of explosions near our position, nothing has been struck directly at this building, thank God.
There were some journalists that were killed and wounded just today. There was a building that was hit. What do you know about that?
Israel targeted, as it has admitted, two media buildings. They're sort of apartment blocks in sort of Western language here in Gaza. There are a handful of media blocks, but two were hit today, including one which was razed to the ground, at least one which was razed to the ground. Now, in these attacks on those two buildings, Israel was saying that it was trying to target communication equipment, that its intelligence, its very good intelligence, had told them they needed to target. But obviously that's somewhat problematic when there's full of civilian journalists, and actually then invokes a war crime targeting journalists. So Israel has bizarrely actually said, yes, we did target this building. Sorry, we ended up injuring 8 journalists and one that had to have his leg amputated. So that was quite a bizarre sort of, if you like, quasi-admission of a war crime. So that was one of the bizarre and very tragic developments of today.
As a Westerner yourself, I mean, how do you feel being in Gaza? And you've been there for, how long have you been in Gaza? And tell me about your life there.
Well, I have a reasonably fulfilling life here in the respect that there are not many internationals here who care about the Palestinian plight. There are not many internationals who care about the Palestinian plight. And then out of the international journalists here, it's difficult to really find many who are actually convicted to help the Palestinian people. For many, for most, I would assert, it's really just a job. So doing work here, trying to passionately get the Palestinian message with all of its detail out to the world is a very fulfilling thing to do. I've been here now on this reporting mission, my second, for I think 19 days now, since the 3rd of November, and I've spent now about 9 weeks in the Gaza Strip in total this year. I was here earlier this year for my first reporting mission in Gaza for about 6 weeks, documenting various aspects of the occupation and siege here in Gaza.
What do you expect to happen next, tomorrow, the next day? Do you have any? There's talk about Israeli troops on the border, but then that's been a rumor for many days. Well, it's not a rumor, but whether they'll move in or not. What do you expect?
My expectation is that within 2 weeks, a ceasefire will be agreed between the Palestinian resistance groups and the State of Israel, probably with Egyptian mediation as usual, perhaps with some regional mediation in Turkey or something like this. I don't think, though, that... I mean, Israel will never be satisfied because there will always be an armed Palestinian resistance. So Israel has automatically lost the fight because its objective was to obliterate all Palestinian resistance groups. So that will never happen. As for the resistance groups' objectives are to certainly, at least, end the policy of targeted assassination, particularly by drones, by Israeli forces outside of this wartime. And to secondly, their second condition is to end the siege on Gaza. Now, we've heard in the last 20 minutes, it's just before 10 o'clock here in Gaza on Sunday, that 90% of the conditions of a ceasefire agreement have been roughly agreed to by both sides, the Palestinian militant wings and the State of Israel. But we've also heard in the same time that Hamas will not accept a ceasefire along the current tangents. There's obviously something within that 10% of conditions that is totally unacceptable for the Palestinian resistance group of Hamas.
Thank you, Harry Fear, and stay safe tonight. I'll be putting all your links and your live stream or Ustream link onto the Mindenki Yoga blog so people can watch you live.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening yourself.
That was Harry Fear. Thank you very much for participating in Mindenki Yoga, and I hope to hear from you more in the future. And let's listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Ofer Naiman, the Israeli peace activist living in Jerusalem.
Can't give life, it can only take it away. Oh, war, good God, yo.
So next we're going to have Ofer Naiman. We've had him on the show before as well. I think the last time we talked to him was about the Palestinian Authority's attempt at getting full UN recognition at the United Nations, which still has not happened. So let's talk to Ofer Naiman, and he's going to explain things from his own peace activist, peace and justice activist perspective, living in Jerusalem as an Israeli. Ofer Naiman, thank you for coming to the Mindenki Yoga radio show. And we've talked before, maybe a year ago now, but here we are in another war, and if you will call it that, with Gaza, the Palestinian territory of Gaza. First of all, introduce yourself and tell me about the activism you're involved in and where you live.
Thank you very much. I'm an Israeli citizen. I live in West Jerusalem. I'm active in the in various campaigns against Israel's policies of occupation and apartheid towards the Palestinian people, which are catastrophic for both peoples as far as I'm concerned. I'm active with the BDS campaign, an international campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israeli institutions. I'm also a co-editor of an Israeli website run by volunteers called The Occupation Magazine, which people can find online. People can also find online our Israeli boycott, divestment, and sanctions page. It's boycottisrael.info. That's the link for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions Israeli group.
Thank you. Can you explain, from what you know from the media in Israel and also from your own sources, like what is the situation with the in Gaza right now and the Israeli war in Gaza?
The situation in Gaza is appalling all the time. I mean, not just now, but right now. And, you know, I've never been to Gaza, but I can read and read testimonies and see the clips and realize what's going on. I mean, people live under the constant noise of drones and fighter planes and bombardments, which really shake the foundations of buildings over there. People can hardly get any sleep. Of course, people in southern Israel are also suffering to some extent, not to the same extent. We care about all the people, but basically, you know, the people of Gaza are going through a nightmare. And it's not just when there are bombings, because they are under a constant siege and occupation. You know, even fishermen from Gaza, they can't go very far into the sea to fish. They may be shot at by Israeli Navy warplanes. Medical patients from Gaza who seek treatment outside the Gaza Strip may be extorted by the Israeli security forces, for example, telling them that if you're not going to collaborate with us, we will not let you receive treatment. And these are just a few examples of the meaning of life in Gaza under an ongoing Israeli occupation. Even though in 2005 Israel dismantled its settlements, the occupation still goes on. In fact, another example, Israel still controls a strip of land inside the Gaza Strip. Of course, they call it a security buffer or whatever, but, you know, even in terms of territory, there is some territory under Israeli control. It's a no-entry zone. If Palestinians enter that zone, they're immediately shot at.
It seems to be a problem in the media and how they describe Israel not occupying Gaza. Like you say, there's this buffer zone. There's constant air flights by drones and everything above it, and plus the sea. I mean, what is this place if it's not occupied? I mean, if there's not soldiers in the streets, then therefore it's not an occupation. It seems like a strange definition.
Yeah, I would subscribe to the definition of Gaza right now as a ghetto under Israeli military control. I mean, it's very difficult to go into the ghetto and out of the ghetto, and inside life is hard. There's a siege, a real siege. And you know that until a year ago, there was even this draconian policy of calorie restriction, you know, counting the number of calories per Palestinian, of daily calories per Palestinian. which is absolutely appalling, a criminal policy. So I would call it a ghetto.
In terms of it being a war, I mean, there's certainly rockets that are being shot from the Gaza Strip by different military forces there, not just Hamas, but I guess Hamas as well. And compared to the Israeli Defense Forces, I mean, what is the difference or between the two?
Well, I mean, there's a huge imbalance of power. Yes, of course, it's very, very unpleasant, can be even lethal to be exposed to Palestinian rocket firing. It's not the same. Life is not easy in southern Israel, but Israeli bombs can kill so many more people. True, they're also more accurate, but the way Israel has been using its munitions in Gaza, especially in Operation Kaslet, quite indiscriminately. I mean, Israel killed so many children and civilians in Operation Kaslet, wiped out entire neighborhoods. Wasn't really discriminate, so it's much worse under to live under the influence of Israeli weapons.
So, and you're an activist against this kind of thing in Israel. But what is the response within Israel? I mean, from Israeli society in general, but also from yourself and your friends, how are you responding?
Well, I mean, first of all, about Israeli society at large, of course, people are lining up behind the leadership and saying we have no choice. A great deal of incitement and hatred against Palestinians on the social media and so on. Israel's Defense Minister Ehud Barak seems to be making some political gains from this, according to the latest polls. His party will have 6 seats in the Israeli parliament. Before the war, it had something like two, and maybe not even that. In general, this is quite similar to Operation Kaslet, maybe with one difference: people seem to be a bit more tired, and even though there is a great deal of jingoism, and people, of course, report for duty as reserve soldiers, people seem to be perhaps a bit more skeptical in seeing this as a cure, something that will solve the problems. So yes, there's a great deal of nationalism here, incitement also against people like us here, like friends of mine who are activists. Overall, Israeli society seems to be a bit more tired after Operation Kaslet, but no real change of heart. People support the policies, the criminal policies.
Now, there was a kind of a, what was it, the J14 movement, right? Where there's kind of an Occupy style mass protest in Tel Aviv, I guess it was based in, right? And it never really got to the point where it was dealing with the issue of the occupation. Is that movement responding to the situation in Gaza right now?
Well, the J14 movement is quite defunct nowadays. Some of its leading members are now very, very busy in the primaries for various parties. For example, many of them are competing for a nice position on the Labour Party list. And of course, the Labour Party is a part of the problem. Their leader, Shelly Yachimovich, who the so-called enlightened social leader, is absolutely appalling. She supports Israel's militarism. She's unwilling to speak out against Israeli settlements. Of course, during times of war, she's even worse. In general, for J14, the occupation doesn't seem to be a real social problem, just a polarizing issue. Most of them don't wish to discuss it and include it in their activism, which is a shame.
And approximately 4 years ago, when it was Kaslet, the first version of the attack on Gaza, or at least a more recent version of it was right after a U.S. election and just before a new Israeli election. Is this by accident that this is the same scenario? Has it happened again?
No, as far as I'm concerned, people here are holding signs such as "No to the election war," and that was also a headline for a petition which has already been signed by approximately 1,000 Israeli citizens, dissidents. So, no, I don't think so. It's an election war. Of course, there are other factors here. I mean, there's a general policy of divide and conquer, dividing the Palestinian people into separate units, divide and rule the people of Gaza, the people of the West Bank, one sector under Hamas, another under the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian diaspora, Israeli-Palestinian citizens. It's a strategy, and this strategy is not related only to the elections, but right now there are people who can profit from it, especially Ehud Barak. Because he was running, he's running with his own party, and before that, the polls were giving him something like two mandates, maybe even less than that. Without two mandates, he cannot even make it to the Knesset. Beyond that, if we have right now, before the elections, we have a military agenda, we won't have a social economic agenda. People will find it more difficult to discuss the real pressing issues for for ordinary Israelis, such as deteriorating standards of living, problems with welfare, health and education services, and so on. So it serves the interests of some powerful Israeli politicians. And as I said, even the so-called opposition is very glad to go along with the Labour Party.
So, what political forces, well, just say within the Knesset itself, what political forces do you believe are show a light out of this mess?
A light out of this mess through the Israeli parliament? I cannot see that happening. I cannot see that happening. We only have something like we have a wishy-washy leftist so-called Zionist party called Meretz with 3 seats out of 120. They tend to be opposed to such actions. We have one Jewish Arab party with 4 mandates out of 120. And beyond that, two other parties representing Israel's Palestinian citizens, something like maybe 10% out of the Israeli parliament. That's nothing, and that's not going to change through the election. So I don't think a change can come from the Israeli parliament, not from the left wing. Maybe from an Israeli de Klerk after we have a sufficiently strong campaign of sanctions against Israel, like the campaign we had against white South Africa. But a change coming from within, from the left, I cannot see that happening.
Wow. Okay. And so let's talk about the international thing with the BDS campaigns, etc. I mean, sitting here in Europe, or people maybe listening from North America as well, I mean, do we have any influence on how Israeli politics plays out?
Yeah, I mean, in general, Israelis would like to think of themselves as a villa in the jungle, a Western villa. And if civil society in the West, and of course Western politicians who have been a part of the problem, refuse to support Israel's criminal policies, then I think Israeli decision makers will be pressed into doing something. As I said, I mean, many people are profiting from the status quo, powerful sectors of Israeli society. And with sufficient pressure from the outside, especially from the West, I think that things can be changed. It won't be easy. You have to understand the mindset of Israeli society. It's sort of a collectively post-traumatic society. And the post-trauma is passed on from one generation to another in an engineered way. People are being brainwashed into thinking that these people want to annihilate us and so on, especially the Arabs, and that the world hates Jews. But still, I mean, I think that many Israelis are seeking a normal life. And if international sanctions, not all sanctions, cultural sanctions against Israeli institutions, economic sanctions against Israeli companies and international companies which profit from Israel's policies. If such sanctions are implemented extensively, led by civil society in the West, then I think that Israelis will have to sort of confront this situation and ask themselves tough questions. So basically, we're trying to present an alternative to war, because without intervention by concerned citizens all over the world, we'll just have more and more of this violence. And with this imbalance of power, Palestinians will always pay a heavier price. Of course, we may see at some point a popular uprising, especially in the West Bank, against both the Palestinian Authority, which is somewhat complicit in all this, and against the Israeli occupation. And if and when that happens, of course, there will be even a greater need for solidarity from concerned people all over the world.
What would you tell to Western activists that are looking at, I mean, yes, they're, quote, just rockets being shot from Gaza, and of course it's disproportionate, but I feel like a lot of people default on wanting to condemn both sides, which of course is a good thing to say, but how do you say that and while also expressing this disbalance in between a giant military and basically very little. How do you
Yeah, I mean,
articulate that?
I would say, I mean, look at the facts. You know, even you can read websites by Israeli human rights groups, groups such as B'Tselem or Physicians for Human Rights, and learn for yourselves about what's going on here. I mean, Israel is using overwhelming force against the Palestinian population, and again, not just at times of a so-called war. That's simply the everyday situation for Palestinians living under overwhelming Israeli force through siege, bureaucracy, for example, extortion, previously mentioned extortion by the Israeli security services. Simply try and read and learn and see what it means to be a Palestinian under Israeli occupation in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip.
Going back to the BDS thing, I mean, what do you suggest, or how do you recommend making that part of activism, the BDS concept?
Well, I mean, people can take action on a very local level and on a very global level. For example, even vigils in front of your local Israeli consulate are important. And if you have, like, for example, nearby the headquarters of a company, not necessarily an Israeli company, even an international company which profits from Israel's occupation, you can start an ongoing campaign against that company by advocacy, asking people to boycott this company, to deny various contracts all over the world. You can distribute leaflets to people, for example, telling them that a great deal of the agricultural produce coming into the EU is Israeli and comes from Israeli companies which profit directly from the occupation. They market stuff that comes out from Israeli settlements, for example, and people should not buy that.
Is
So,
that legal? Taking materials and producing things on in occupied territories and exporting that, is that legal? I mean, from an international law perspective.
well, the entire colonial project, the settlement project, is illegal according to international law, but Israel doesn't care, and Israel will get away with it as long as too many people all over the world are indifferent. So no, it's not legal, and there is an initiative right now to ban Israeli settlement products from the EU. We know that even the Irish foreign minister is trying to take action on this. We do hope that other EU politicians join the minister, the Irish minister, on that, because too many European politicians have been complicit for various reasons, supporting Israeli crimes.
Do you have any last thoughts that I can? What's my last question I should ask you?
Well, basically, we're simply encouraging concerned people all over the world to get in touch with Israeli groups and with Israeli citizens who oppose Israeli policies. We need your support, and you could probably use our support, so we can all work together on this.
Thank you very much, Ofer, and thanks for the report from Israel.
My pleasure.
That was Ofer Neiman. Thank you again for being on the Mindenki Yoga radio show. I'll put in various links to things that he's doing on the Mindenki Yoga blog, which is at lmv.hu/MindenkiYoga, MindenkiYoga. And now let's listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to listen to Democracy Now!, which is going to focus on the Gaza situation. And I think it's very important to listen to this Mindenki Yoga, or sorry, this version of this edition of Democracy Now!, because Amy Goodman is going to be interviewing Gershon Baskin, who's an Israeli negotiator with Hamas. Now, I mean, the myth is that Israel does not negotiate with Hamas. Absolutely not. This is against their principles, you know. But the truth is, there's always back-channel negotiations. This is the reality of the world. It's always negotiations. And so Gershon Baskin is one of these negotiators. And the first person that the Israelis killed at the beginning of this military operation was this guy named Ahmed Jabari, who is the top general of Hamas. And he was the guy who he was negotiating with. So the first thing that the Israelis did at the beginning of this war was to kill the guy that they were negotiating with, which is an amazing thing. You don't see this on CNN, and you barely even see it on BBC. So this is an important thing. So Amy Goodman is interviewing the guy who was negotiating indirectly through the channels, back channels, blah blah blah. Ahmed Jabari, who was the guy that was the first guy that the Israelis killed. So why did they kill him? This is the question. So let's listen to some music, and then we'll go straight into Democracy Now!
What do you call it when a movement takes up arms and seizes power by the barrel of a gun? Moves into the homes of those they've dispossessed and says this whole country is ours now that we've won. What do you call a government that forces families from their homes and turns them into refugees? All the while complaining of these dirty tent dwellers that it's they who want to drive us into the sea. What do you call a government that builds walls around the ghettos and only looks at you through sniper sights? Who uses your cheap labor to build those very walls while they tell the world how they believe in human rights? What do you call a government that makes war upon their neighbors who annexes land for living room? Who conducts a foreign policy based on threats and bombing raids, whose opponents often end up in a prison or a tomb? What do you call a government who talks of enemies within and seals off the camps to make sure they cannot eat, who keeps their prisoners on diets to guarantee an early death with their mantra, "History cannot repeat"? What do you call a government that puts numbers on the arms of the people that they torture and arrest, whose soldiers commit war crimes systematically while they proclaim their conduct is superior at best? What do you call a government that bombs its starving subjects after taking from them everything they had? Whose citizens are soldiers, brainwashed to believe their opponents are fanatics, terrorists, or mad? What do you call it when a movement takes up arms and seizes power by the barrel of a gun? Moves into the homes of those they've dispossessed and says this whole country is ours now that we've won.
Some other terrorist organizations are employing against the people of Israel. Speaking later Thursday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Mark Toner said the onus is on Hamas to stop the violence.
Let me be very clear. The onus here is on Hamas. And, as Jay Carney just said from the White House, it claims to have the best interests of the Palestinian people at heart, but through its actions, it's showing a far different agenda.
Israel's also continued to prepare for a potential ground invasion of Gaza by calling up thousands of army reservists. Egyptian Prime Minister Hesham Kandil visited the Gaza Strip Friday in a show of solidarity amidst fragile hopes he might broker a truce. BP has agreed to plead guilty to criminal charges and pay $4.5 billion to the U.S. government for the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico that killed 11 people and caused the worst offshore oil spill in U.S. history. The payment includes $4 billion related to criminal charges, including $1.2 billion in criminal fines, as well as $500 million in payments to securities regulators. Attorney General Eric Holder said Thursday the settlement broke two records.
BP has agreed to plead guilty to all 14 criminal charges, including responsibility for the deaths of 11 people and the events that led to an unprecedented environmental catastrophe. The company has also agreed to pay $4 billion in fines and in penalties. This marks both the largest single criminal fine, more than $1.25 billion, and the largest total criminal resolution, $4 billion, in the history of the United States.
Critics say even the record numbers reflected in the settlement represent just a fraction of BP's profits and will not be enough to deter future disasters. Public Citizen called the settlement pathetic and a slap on the wrist, noting the deal did not prevent BP from continuing to receive lucrative government contracts and leases. Under the settlement, BP agreed to plead guilty to 11 felony counts of misconduct or neglect in connection with the death of 11 rig workers, as well as a separate felony count for lying to Congress. Separately, Thursday, the government pursued charges against three BP employees for their role in the disaster. The top BP officers who were aboard the drill rig, Robert Kaluza and Donald Vidrine, were charged with manslaughter for their alleged negligence after the government says they became aware of multiple signs the well was unsafe. BP's former vice president for exploration in the Gulf of Mexico, David Rainey, was charged with obstruction of Congress and making false statements about how quickly oil was gushing from the well. President Obama paid a visit to New York Thursday to survey the damage after Superstorm Sandy devastated the region 2.5 weeks ago. Thousands still remain without power as the death toll from Sandy in the U.S. and Canada has climbed to 128. Speaking in the hard-hit borough of Staten Island, Obama pledged to help with both the short- and long-term recovery.
So there's a lot of short-term, immediate stuff that has to be dealt with, and we are going to make sure that we stay here as long as people need that immediate help. That's FEMA's primary task. And we'll be coordinating closely with state and local governments to make sure folks are getting the short-term help. But what we've also already heard is that there's going to be some long-term rebuilding that's required.
Top congressional leaders are heading to the White House today to begin talks with President Obama on an agreement to avert the so-called fiscal cliff of tax cuts and spending hikes set to kick in at the end of the year. Obama's vowed to reject any extension of the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans as part of the deal, while Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell Thursday warned he would oppose any attempt to raise taxes. Ahead of the talks, a group of lawmakers led by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders called for a deficit reduction plan that would preserve benefits like Social Security. Sanders spoke during the press conference Thursday.
Send a loud message to the leadership in the House, in the Senate, and President Obama. Do not cut Social Security. Do not cut Medicare. Do not cut Medicaid. Do not cut. I do not often quote Ronald Reagan. That's true. But this is what Ronald Reagan said on October 7, 1984. Ronald Reagan, quote, Social Security has nothing to do with the deficit. Social Security is totally funded by the payroll tax levied on employer and employee. If you reduce the ACO of Social Security, that money would not go into the general fund to reduce the deficit. End of quote, Ronald Reagan.
Texas Congress member and former Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul has given his farewell speech to the House of Representatives in a more than 45-minute address Wednesday. Paul assessed his own legacy, blasted U.S. policy at home and abroad, and posed a series of questions.
Why can't people understand that war always destroys wealth and liberty? Why is there so little concern for the executive order that gives the president authority to establish a kill list, including American citizens, of those targeted for assassination? Why is patriotism thought to be blind loyalty to the government and the politicians who run it, rather than loyalty to the principles of liberty and support for the people? Real patriotism is a willingness to challenge the government when it's wrong.
Congressmember Ron Paul retiring at the end of the year. The Associated Press has revealed a unit of Honduran soldiers accused of killing a 15-year-old boy in May were trained, vetted, and equipped by the U.S. government. Evidianis was shot dead by soldiers who chased him when he drove through a military checkpoint on his father's motorcycle. The AP's investigation details an alleged attempt by officers to cover up the killing. It turned out the truck used in the chase had been supplied by the United States, and the unit had been vetted by the U.S. as free of corruption and human rights abuses. A State Department official told the AP that this week, the U.S. may withhold as much as half of all aid to Honduras for this year out of concern over human rights violations. Meanwhile, two human rights groups say they've submitted evidence to the International Criminal Court regarding targeted killings and other human rights abuses that have taken place in Honduras since the 2009 coup that ousted President Manuel Zelaya. The Center for Constitutional Rights and the International Federation for Human Rights submitted information about the targeted killings of journalists, union leaders, and activists and human rights lawyers amidst what they say is a climate of rampant political persecution and impunity. A new report by Reuters has found the war in Afghanistan has had devastating psychological consequences on Afghans, particularly children who've grown up amidst constant violence. One mental health worker at a hospital in Kabul said many children born around the time of the 2001 invasion suffer from nightmares, depression, anxiety, and incontinence. The news comes as the United States opened talks Thursday with Afghanistan over its continued role in the country after most foreign troops withdraw in 2014. A bribery scandal involving the retail giant Walmart could be widening from Mexico to multiple other countries, the company reported Thursday. The New York Times had previously uncovered how Walmart paid Mexican officials millions of dollars in bribes to win construction permits in Mexico. Now the company says it's uncovered enough evidence to merit bribery concerns about its business practices in China, India, and Brazil. The news comes as hundreds of Walmart workers walked off the job this week to protest low wages, poor benefits, and alleged retaliation from management. Workers have promised a wave of strikes and protests next week, culminating in a massive day of action on Black Friday, the biggest shopping day of the year. The Spanish government has approved a 2-year suspension of evictions for some of the neediest homeowners who are unable to pay their mortgages amidst an economic crisis that's seen hundreds of thousands lose their homes. Spain's mortgage crisis was thrown into the spotlight after two recent eviction-related suicides. Spain's finance minister outlined the changes Thursday. The changes to Spanish mortgage law came after a growing mass movement pressured the government to act. But activists said Thursday's reforms still fail to address the issue that Spain's homeowners remain saddled with debt even after they lose their homes. In Ireland, thousands have taken to the streets in protest following the death of a woman who was denied access to abortion. Savita Halappanavar had begged doctors for an abortion after finding out she was already miscarrying her 17-week pregnancy. Doctors refused, reportedly telling her Ireland is a Catholic country. The 31-year-old died from septic shock after doctors finally removed the fetus once its heartbeat had stopped. Ireland, which is some of the world's most restrictive abortion, permits abortion if a woman's life is at risk, but does not specify how severe the threat must be. The Irish government is now vowing to clarify the law. On Thursday, Deputy Prime Minister Eamon Gilmore called for the change before Parliament.
I have said very clearly that we need to bring legal clarity to this issue. We need to ensure that in this country that we do not have a doubt which arises in a hospital, in a set of circumstances, which puts a mother's life at risk.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
And Juan, it is wonderful to have you back after back surgery and your recovery. It's great to be sitting next to you.
Amy, it's great to be back. It's been a few months now, and I want to thank all the Democracy Now! Listeners and viewers for all the emails they've sent over the past few days with recommendations for my recovery from back surgery and their own experiences, sharing with me their own experiences of their back problems. And it's great to be back, great to be walking again, because I was bedridden for about a month before my surgery.
Well, it's fantastic to have you back. Maybe we should publish a book of Democracy Now! Listeners and viewers' back problems and how to solve them.
I didn't realize there were so many. Well, Israel is continuing to pound the Gaza Strip with airstrikes amidst fears that Israel could launch a ground invasion. At least 21 Palestinians have died in the most recent round of violence, while three Israelis died on Thursday. Israel said it launched 150 airstrikes overnight, while Palestinians fired dozens of rockets into Israel. Israel has started to draft 30,000 reserve troops, and a sign the assault may soon widen. Among the casualties of Israeli violence was the 11-month-old son of a BBC Arabic journalist. An Associated Press photo showed journalist Jihad Mishrawi clutching the wrapped body of his baby, who was killed by an Israeli round that struck his home Wednesday. Earlier today, Egyptian Prime Minister Hisham Kandil traveled to Gaza to condemn the Israeli attack.
We cannot stay silent about this tragedy. The entire world should be responsible regarding this aggression. Egypt, Egypt, the revolution will not spare any efforts to exert every effort to stop this aggression and achieve a sustainable truce.
Meanwhile, in Washington, we're joined by two guests right now. We're joined by the award-winning Palestinian journalist Mohammed Omer. We want to thank you very much for being with us back again. Thank you so much. Tell us what is happening on the ground in Gaza right now.
You're welcome, Amy. Well, let me start with the last. I'm right now in Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, where the Israeli F-16 missiles just fired at least two missiles, killing one person, and the person was just arrived to the hospital, Nasser Hospital at the moment, and he was identified as Ismail Kandil, 24-year-old. That brings the number of the airstrikes in the last 3 days to 502 airstrikes. This resulted in the killing of 23 Palestinians, mostly civilians, and over 230 people who were injured. One thing that we ought to talk about here is the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. This is a situation of targeting a population of civilians, exactly like Israel is shooting in a fish pile, and there is no bunker or there is no shelter and there is nowhere to run for the general population. Gaza is living in a very dire situation. The UN has decided to shut all the schools tomorrow, as well as the Ministry of Education and Higher Education called all the universities not to open tomorrow. Gaza hospitals announced the need for medical supplies and medical stocks. I was just speaking to a number of doctors at the Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, and they announced that they are in bad need for 192 types of medicines that are not available in the stocks of the Ministry of Health or the hospitals. There is also the need for 450 items of medical supplies, or what they call disposable medical items. If these needs are not met by the next day or two, there will be a big humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. The situation is deteriorating in the Gaza Strip. The target is indeed civilians. The last one, it was Hanin Tafish, a 10-month baby child who was killed by an Israeli missile. The missiles are falling at the moment as I speak to you, and as breaking news coming out from the medical crew next to me, the F-16s are targeting the beach camp in the east of Gaza City at the moment. The Israeli army, or the Israeli F-16s at the moment, they are targeting the beach camp in the west of Gaza City at the moment. That's the breaking news, and it's happening as we speak at the moment.
And Mohammed, the reports are that the leaders of the Hamas government are in hiding, fearing possible attempts to assassinate some of them as well. Is the general population or the security forces there preparing for a possible Israeli invasion again?
Well, there is no way to determine that, because walking in the streets or driving in the streets, you really don't see anybody in the streets. The streets are entirely empty. I was just driving from Gaza City to Khan Yunis in the south, and the streets are entirely empty. There is no people who are walking in the streets because the airstrikes are bombing everything that moves. Everything that moves in the streets is being bombed and attacked. And this makes things quite difficult for the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. There are talks about the big invasion targeting the Gaza Strip. We don't know if this is starting, but I can confirm to you that in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, Rafah and Khan Yunis, there is an unusual military buildup. We hear some tanks and bulldozers gathering around the borderline, but we don't know yet, as the operation, or a larger scale operation on the ground, did not start yet, but its potential with the Israeli threats at the moment. Just to clarify the last breaking news I gave you about 2 minutes ago, the target in the west of Gaza City is a car driving in Gaza City. It's a car driving in Gaza City, and so far the medical crew are not aware who is the target, and they cannot determine if there are casualties. But they say there are casualties, but we don't know the number yet.
I'm looking at a piece by Max Fisher in The Washington Post that talks about the killing of the 11-month-old son of BBC journalist Jihad Mishrawi. Not only was his little baby killed, but this Israeli round hit Mishrawi's four-room house, killing his sister-in-law, wounding his brother. According to BBC Middle East bureau chief Paul Danaher, who is with him in Gaza, he said, "We're all one team in Gaza." After spending a few hours with his grieving colleague, Danaher wrote on Twitter, Questioned asked here is, if Israel can kill a man riding on a moving motorbike as they did last month, how did Jihad's son get killed? I want to turn as well to Gershon Baskin now, founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, the initiator of the secret talks between Israel and Hamas for the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. He is speaking to us from Jerusalem. Gershon, can you talk about the assassination of Jabri, the military head of Hamas, and the significance of this, as reported in Haaretz? What Jabri received just before he was assassinated?
Well, Jabri, as the leader of the military wing of Hamas's Adin al-Qassam, was the person who was called on by the Egyptians and by his own leaders to enforce previous ceasefire understandings that were reached between Israel and Hamas after each round of rocket fire emerged over the past years. With the increasing intensity of the rocket fire and the shortening of the periods of ceasefires between myself and my counterpart in Hamas, who we worked together on the Shalit prisoner exchange deal, Razi Hamad, the deputy foreign minister, proposed to the parties that they enter into a long-term ceasefire understanding with mechanisms that define what are breaches and what are not breaches and how to deal with emerging situations that are defined by Israel as impending terrorist attacks. I had written a draft about 8 months ago. The draft was circulated around to Israeli officials, Hamas officials, the Egyptian intelligence, and the United Nations. It was rejected, or it was decided by Hamas and Israel at that time not to decide, not to make a decision on it. About a month ago, when the intensity of the fighting continued again, Razi Hamad and I decided to give it another chance, and we talked together and tried to make the proposal that I had initially written a little bit less complex, easy to understand and perhaps easy to implement, and it was also designed as a trial period of between 3 to 6 months. I met Razi Hamad last week in Cairo. We talked about it. He went to begin showing it to the Hamas officials. He showed to some Hamas officials sitting in Cairo. They told him to go back to Gaza and to show it to the military and political officials back in Gaza. And he did that on Wednesday morning. He was showing it around to Ahmed Jabri and other people. I was supposed to receive from him that evening a copy of the draft that he had written in Arabic for me to deliver to the Israeli side and to the Egyptian intelligence, which I was not able to do in the end.
Because he was assassinated.
That's right.
Well, Gershon, I want to read part of a recent piece in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz about the Israeli assassination of Hamas military commander Ahmed Jabri. The article by Aluf Ben is titled, Israel Killed Its Subcontractor in Gaza. It begins, quote, Ahmed Jabri was a subcontractor in charge of maintaining Israel's security in Gaza. This title will no doubt sound absurd to anyone who in the past several hours has heard Jabri described as an arch terrorist or the terror chief of staff or our bin Laden. But that was the reality for the past 5.5 years. Israel demanded of Hamas that it observe the truce in the south and enforce it on the multiple other armed groups in the Gaza Strip. The man responsible for carrying out this policy was Ahmed Jabri. In return for enforcing the quiet, which was never perfect, Israel funded the Hamas regime through the flow of money in armored trucks to banks in Gaza and continued to supply infrastructure and medical services to the inhabitants of the Gaza Strip. Your response to that article and placing Jabri in the context of the security situation in Gaza over the past few years?
Well, I don't want it to be misinterpreted. Ahmed Jabri was not a man of peace. He was not an angel in any way. He was a warrior. He was a fighter. He was the person responsible for the Hamas coup d'etat, which was conducted in June of 2007, when they brutally executed some of the Palestinian Authority security personnel. He was a strong military man who refused to speak to Israelis directly. I never had direct contact with him. It was always through third parties, other people in Hamas or other people. He never talked about peace. The truce that we were talking about was not a peace agreement. So it has to be clear, Jabri was a deeply religious Muslim who believed in the cause of Hamas and the ideology of Hamas, which includes the destruction of Israel. But Jabri also saw over the last year or two a continuation of this policy of having periodic fighting with Israel that left always in every round between 10 and 30 Palestinians killed in Gaza, a lot of destruction, and almost no one killed in Israel. The lack of balance of power and force is so obvious here that Jabri came to the conclusion, along with others in Hamas, that this was futile, a futile way to fight Israel, and they wanted a timeout. During the timeout, it was obvious that they were going to continue to build their forces, continue to smuggle in weapons through the tunnels and other ways to build up their rocket potential, longer-range rockets, anti-aircraft missiles. So this was Jabri's thinking. Now, my perspective on this was that Israel had to secure quiet. It is unacceptable for the civilian population in the south of Israel to be constantly under the threat of rocket fire from Gaza. There are several ways to achieve that quiet. One is to do what Israel is doing now, to assassinate people, to put 2.5 million people in 1.6 million people in Gaza under rocket fire, to put another million people in Israel under rocket fire, to kill a lot of people, to do a lot of damage. In the end, we'll create some kind of deterrence and have quiet for a period of time. Or we could try what we've never tried before, and that's engagement, dialogue, and trying to reach some longer-term understandings. I don't know if it would have worked. Honestly, I don't know if Jabri would have held to the terms of the agreements, if the other factions would have given into that. My point was, let's try it. We've never done it before. Let's try it. Maybe we'll have a dynamic of its own, which instead of leading to more escalation, will actually bring about de-escalation and a possibility of having a new kind of relationship with Gaza.
Gershon Baskin and Mohammed Omer, I want to ask you both the response where you each are, respectively, to these attacks right now. Gershon Baskin in Jerusalem and Mohammed Omer and his way to Khan Yunis.
Pardon, Mohammed.
Yeah, shukran. Well, there is also more of this attack, just to bring more breaking news. An Israeli airstrike just targeted a motorcycle in the west of Gaza City at the moment as we speak. The ambulances are on their way to evacuate the people who were targeted. There is another new Israeli F-16 missile. We don't know if it's a 16 missile or if it's the armed drones which fired a new round of missiles on the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Let me just mention something about back to the humanitarian situation. Today, the Egyptian Prime Minister made a visit to the Gaza Strip, Hisham Kandil, and he was able to see the destruction and the damage caused to the Palestinian population. And he was at Shifa Hospital holding one of the babies who was injured. And we could see that the Prime Minister, his T-shirt had a lot of blood in his from this child who's injured, who actually died in the hands of the Egyptian Prime Minister today, as he was speaking to the media. Other thing that I would like to mention here that about the crossings in the Gaza Strip, the Rafah crossing is open today. Kerem Shalom is closed. Erez crossing was open in the morning. Now it's closed even for humanitarian cases, according to the United Nations and according to my observation and counting. There is 12 houses that were completely demolished in the last 3 days. About 150 houses, including mosques, roads, schools, and farmlands, are being targeted, even kindergarten for children. Makes the question where the Gazans are going to hide when the Israeli F-16s are firing missiles day and night.
And Gershon Baskin.
Yeah, I think, Amy, I mean, it's the same situation in Israel. I have an iPhone application here, which is called Tseva Adom, red color, the color red, which warns people when a missile is being fired into Israel. I'm getting these now almost every other minute. It's very good for geography lessons because I'm learning the name of every town in the south of Israel. Not only in the south, it's a wider region now as well. And here we have the civilian population under fire. It's not targeted at all at military targets. It's fired at the civilian population in Israel. And the Israelis are angry. The Israelis don't know why they're being targeted from Gaza. From the Israel point of view, there is ready understanding of the situation. Israel left Gaza in 2005 and stopped the occupation of Gaza from their perspective without having a single settlement left there or single military personnel on the land of Gaza, and the civilian population has been targeted by thousands and thousands of rockets. Since the beginning of this operation, since the assassination of Jabri, there's been more than 500 rockets sent entirely on the civilian population. Not one of the targets is a military target.
Well, Gershon Baskin, I'd like to ask you, 4 years ago, after the presidential election and before President Obama was inaugurated, the Israeli government launched an invasion of Gaza and actually pulled the troops back just before President Obama was inaugurated. Now, once again, after a presidential election, the Israeli government has been taking actions against the population in Gaza. But the difference now is the situation has changed dramatically in the Arab world, especially in Egypt. What is your sense of the Egyptian government's the test that this poses to the Egyptian government and its relationship both to Israel and to the Palestinians?
Well, I think we're seeing by the nature of the operation that Israel is conducting now, as opposed to cast lead 4 years ago, is that Israel is taking a lot more care for the what's called the horrible term collateral damage, to be all that less. If there's been, according to Mohammed, 500 sorties so far over Gaza, and there are 23, maybe 24 with the people that he mentioned killed in Gaza, that's significantly less than was in cast lead. My understanding is, and I haven't seen the list of names of all those people killed, but I understand that most of them are combatants. I don't want anyone to be killed, and I think that this whole operation could have been avoided. But the reality is that Israel is considering its relations with Egypt as one of its primary concerns. The Egyptian in military intelligence has played a crucial role in the last years mitigating and negotiating between Israel and Hamas, including with the release of Gilad Shalit, and including in the last ceasefires. I was sitting in Cairo with a senior intelligence officer on Sunday evening when he received a phone call from the head of Islamic Jihad in Gaza informing him that they had agreed to enter into the ceasefire. This was immediately communicated to the Israeli side by the military intelligence in Egypt. So the relationship with Egypt is Israel's most important strategic asset. And another war, a full-fledged war in Gaza with horrendous damage would certainly jeopardize the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt.
We just have 10 seconds left, Mohammed Omar. Are you still
that the majority of the people who were actually targeted are civilians. We're talking about two women among the 23 who were killed, two women, six children, and two elderly people. As I speak right now, there are more people and ambulances are arriving to the Khan Yunis hospital with more casualties who are civilians. The target is here civilians because the military leaders are hiding under the ground. Israel finds nothing else but to attack civilians' population in the Gaza Strip.
Mohammed Omer and Gershon Baskin, I thank you both for being with us. Gershon Baskin, founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, initiator of the secret talks between Israel and Hamas for the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. And thank you to Mohammed Omer, Palestinian journalist based in Gaza, speaking to us from Khan Yunis. In 2008, he won the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Oliver Stone's Untold History of the United States. All that you can see. Palestine colony collapse. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the untold history of the United States. Academy Award-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone has taken on three American presidents in JFK, Nixon, and W. A Vietnam War veteran, he was decorated with a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. As a filmmaker, he's tackled the most controversial aspects of the war, of the Vietnam War, in his classics Platoon and Born on the 4th of July. He revealed the greed of the financial industry in the Hollywood hit Wall Street and the sequel Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps. And he's explored Latin America through his films Salvador, Comandante, and South of the Border.
Now, Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick from American University have teamed up to produce a 10-part Showtime series called Oliver Stone's Untold History of the United States. It also features a companion book with a similar name. Drawing on archival findings and recently declassified documents, the filmmakers critically examine U.S. history from the atomic bombing of Japan to the Cold War to the fall of communism and continuing all the way through to the Obama administration. This is the trailer for the Showtime miniseries.
History is exciting, and I want to make it as exciting as it can be. We take a history subject and we make it not only dramatic, but we are compassionate. I always felt there's a disconnect about what's officially reported and what actually happened. That we can't accept the stuff that's handed down. This is the key to the whole series, is to find out how we got to where we are and who we are. It's a great, great story.
That was the trailer for Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick's 10-part Showtime series called The Untold History of the United States. The first episode of the series aired on Monday night on Showtime. It'll re-air on Monday evenings at 8 p.m. It's also available on demand. For more, the award-winning director Oliver Stone joins us here in New York, and we're joined by his co-author, Peter Kuznick, professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Oliver Stone, you've been working on this for years, unbeknownst to many people. Why?
Well, the trailer looked pretty epic. From here to here, it sounded like a Cecil B. DeMille movie from 1940s to... It was a big job, 4.5 years off and on. I did do 3 feature films and 2 documentaries during that period, but Peter was on the... We started in 2008, and it's been 4.5. We originally discussed Wallace and the bomb in 1997 when he was teaching at an American university, and I was there in one of his classes. And we talked about making a documentary of about an hour and a half. He's an expert on the atomic, on weaponry, and especially the atomic bomb. He founded the Department of Nuclear Studies at American. And Henry Wallace, he can explain to you, is the key to the link. Would we have dropped the bomb? That's the origin myth of this. Every school kid, my daughter in her school, in private school, in good school, is still learning this. We dropped the bomb because we had to, because the Japanese resistance was fanatic, and we would have lost many American lives taking Japan. This is one. There's no alternative to that story, and we are beginning the process in chapter 1, 2, and 3 of saying the bomb did not have to be dropped for strategic reasons and also because it was morally reprehensible. But strategically, it made no sense.
Professor Kuznick, why?
Made no sense because the Japanese were already defeated. They were looking for a way out of the war. The United States knew they were defeated. Truman refers to the intercepted July 18th telegram as the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. The United States
and the Japanese emperor asking for peace.
Yeah, but that was called, he says, the Jap emperor asking for peace is Truman's exact words on that. Everybody else knew that they were militarily defeated and looking for a way out. But the people who knew that the best were the Russians, because they were trying to get the Russians to intervene on their behalf to get them better surrender terms. And also because their strategy was to welcome American invasion and then to inflict heavy damages and then force better surrender terms. But once the Russians invaded, then that undermined both their diplomatic strategy and their military strategy. So that was what really ended the war. It was not the bombing. We'd already been bombing Japanese cities. We'd firebombed over 100 cities. Destruction reached 99.5% of the city of Toyama. From the Japanese standpoint, whether it was 200 bombs, 200 planes and 1,000 bombs, or one plane and one bomb, didn't change the equation. But the Soviet invasion fundamentally changed it, and that's what forced the final surrender.
On August 9th.
Stalin
moved a huge army to the east off the German... from the German frontier to the, and wiped out the Kwantung army in about, I think, 2 days or 1 day,
very
and
very
was
quickly.
Moving towards Japan. So, if you let a month go by, you know, if we really are interested in ending this war and using Russian troops, it's perfect. We can do it.
Well, let's turn to a clip from the series. This one challenges the prevailing logic of World War II being the United States' so-called good war.
Generations of Americans have been taught that the United States reluctantly dropped atomic bombs at the end of World War II to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of young men poised to die in an invasion of Japan. But the story is really more complicated, more interesting, and much more disturbing. Many Americans view World War II nostalgically as the good war in which the United States and its allies triumphed over German Nazism, Italian fascism, and Japanese militarism. Others, not so blessed, remember World War II as the bloodiest war in human history. By the time it was over, 60 to 65 million people lay dead, including an estimated 27 million Soviets, between 10 and 20 million Chinese, 6 million Jews, over 6 million Germans, 3 million non-Jewish Poles, 2.5 million Japanese, and 1.5 million Yugoslavs. Austria, Britain, France, Italy, Hungary, Romania, and the United States each counted between 250,000 and 500,000 dead.
Well, Oliver Stone, the good war, with and of course the war with the most carnage in the history of the world. Right?
It's a huge story, and it's where we begin. But we deal with the three empires, Britain and the U.S., and the rivalry between the U.S. and Britain. A lot of school kids don't know that the British Empire is a dominant empire and has so many resources around the world. And Churchill is fighting, among other things, for the retention of the colonies and all through Middle East. The oil supplies, Greece, very important, North Africa, Egypt, Suez, India, Singapore, and that's what he's trying to get back. And he never starts a second front for about 2 years. It's been promised in 1942 to Stalin. Stalin is, meanwhile, rolling the Germans back and winning the war, as the British and the Americans are periphery pecking retaining the British colonies for Britain. It's an interesting story. The British, for example, go into Athens in 1944 after they've liberated it, so to speak, but they end up fighting in street battles with the communist resistance fighters who fought very heroically against the Nazis. We put in a Greek who was working with the Nazis. Right away, we put him into the premiership. It's a dirty story. Dirty story.
What most Americans don't know about the war, most Americans think that the United States won the war. But the reality is that throughout most of the war, the American and British combined were fighting 10 German divisions. The Russians alone were fighting 200 German divisions. That's why Churchill says it was the Russians who tore the guts out of the Nazi army.
Let's go back to another clip from your series, The Untold History of the United States. This one is about Henry Wallace, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's vice president and agriculture and commerce secretary. It suggests that the Midwestern statesman would have put America on a radically different trajectory had his path to the presidency not been blocked by the Democratic Party leaders in 1944.
Seeing the war clouds gathering clearly on the horizon, Roosevelt decided to break with precedent and run for a third term in 1940 against the strongly anti-war Republican candidate Wendell Willkie, a corporate attorney from Indiana. The stakes were high. The nation might soon be at war. Roosevelt weighed his options and chose his controversial Secretary of Agriculture, Henry A. Wallace, as his running mate. Wallace had overseen an extraordinary return to agricultural prosperity during the Great Depression. These policies had been at the heart of the New Deal. For the urban poor, Wallace also had provided food stamps and school lunches. He instituted programs for land use planning and soil conservation. He carved out his credentials in the New Deal years as an outspoken anti-fascist. Considered the scientific community's best ally, Wallace spoke out strongly against the building up of false racial theories in rebuke of the Hitler policies in Germany.
George Carver, born into slavery, now a chemist at Tuskegee University specializing in botany, first introduced me to the mysteries of plant fertilization. I spent a good many years breeding corn because this scientist deepened my appreciation of plants in a way I could never forget. Superior ability is not the exclusive possession of any one race or any one class, provided men are given the right opportunities.
But Democratic Party bosses feared Wallace's views, mistrusting his devotion to principle over politics. It looked like the Wallace nomination would go up in flames when Roosevelt, angry and frustrated, wrote a remarkable letter to the assembled delegates in which he flatly turned down the presidential nomination.
The Democratic Party has failed when it has fallen to the control of those who think in terms of dollars instead of human values. Until the Democratic Party shakes off all the shackles of control fastened upon it by the forces of conservatism, reaction, and appeasement, it will not continue its march to victory. The party cannot face in both directions at the same time. Therefore, I decline the honor of the nomination for the presidency.
His wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, saved the day. The first president's wife ever to address a convention, she told disgruntled delegates that we face now a grave situation. Party bosses buckled and put Wallace on the ticket. They would, however, come back for their vengeance.
I've just heard the news of my nomination, and there is just one thing I want to say. I am confident that under the leadership of President Roosevelt, we shall have a united Democratic Party, victory in November, and security for the American people.
And that was the voice of Henry Wallace, nominated as vice president. Oliver Stone, your inspiration for this whole series was about Henry Wallace. Why? Talk about his significance.
I would say the inspiration was the bomb, which is perhaps the atomic bomb, because I grew up right in that period. I was born right after it, and I wanted to know. The bomb shaped all our lives, and we lived under in fear of it as we were in school. Air raids, we came near the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it haunts our policy. We were in a Cold War up until 1989-91 with the Soviets. But it continues on, if you noticed. I mean, there was no peace dividend, and I'm wondering what happened in the 1989-91 period all the way through the 90s, and it just keeps going into the war on terror, the war on Noriega, the war on drugs. So you go back, and I talk to Peter, and he knows a lot about the bomb, and did the bomb have to start all this, and do we have to keep doing this? And the bomb is what leads you to Wallace, because Wallace was a key figure. He was supposed to be vice president in 1944, the popular choice. 65% of the Democratic voters wanted him. 2% wanted Truman. And it's an inside deal. It's really ugly. It's like a Frank Capra movie where everything is rigged from the inside. And on one particular night, and it comes down to a moment in time, like 9 seconds, when Wallace almost makes it. He almost squeezes in. The crowd is cheering, Wallace, and the bosses convene the convention that night. And then overnight, they turn favors and so forth and money and bribes. So Wallace does not end up as vice president. Roosevelt dies, and a little unknown party hack, really, called Harry Truman, at one of the most important times in the history of the world, becomes a small man, becomes leader of the world with all the power, and frankly, like a George Bush, he blows it.
Henry Wallace would later run for president.
He would, but as unsuccessful third-party candidate, and he's smeared repeatedly as a communist at that point. But the real drama is the 44 convention.
Wallace was very much of a visionary. He's been lost to history. I ask my students and other people, nobody knows Henry Wallace anymore. He was an extraordinary man. When Henry Luce in 1941 said the 20th century must be the American century, the United States is going to dominate the world in every way, Wallace countered as vice president. And he gave his famous speech, and we said the 20th century must be the century of the common man. He calls for a worldwide people's revolution in the tradition of the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Latin American Revolution, and the Russian Revolution. He says we have to wipe out monopolies and cartels. monopolies and cartels. He says we've got to end colonialism, end imperialism, raise standards of living around the world, and the U.S. and the Soviets have to collaborate to refashion the world at the end of the world. That was the vision that he had. The party bosses hated him, as did the Wall Street people. Wallace said that America's fascists are those who think Wall Street comes first and the country comes second. So the anti-labor people hated him, the people against civil rights hated him, and the people who were against women's rights hated him. He was the exemplar of everything good that the Democratic Party has ever stood for.
Historian Peter Kuznick and three-time Academy Award-winning director Oliver Stone. We'll be back with them in a minute.
You would have liked to. Amy, so you would have liked it.
Why didn't you? مرحبا يا عراق جئت غنيك وبعض من الغناء بكى فجراح الحسين بعض جراح وبصدري من الأسى كربلا فجراح الحسين بعض جراح وبصدري من الأسى كربلا مرحبا يا عراق كيف العبا وكيف المها وكيف الظبا مرحبا يا عراق هل نسبني بعد طول السنين سمرا
مرحبا عراق by Shab Abed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guests are three-time Oscar-winning director Oliver Stone, as well as historian Peter Kuznick. And they have written the book, The Untold History of the United States. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, I also want to ask about President Reagan. In your book, Oliver Stone, The Untold History of the United States, you have a chapter titled Death Squads for Democracy. This is Reagan in 1983 giving an address on Central America.
The strategic importance of Central America, bordering as it does in the Caribbean, our lifeline to the outside world. Two-thirds of all our foreign trade and petroleum pass through the Panama Canal and the Caribbean. In a European crisis, At least half of our supplies for NATO would go through these areas by sea.
Yeah. Well, talk to us about Reagan and Central America policy.
Briefly, Ronald Reagan set American policy back like 20 years. There had been attempts at detente, and he took the Cold War to a new level. He almost took it to the edge of World War again. He said constantly, he said that the Soviet Union was ahead of the United States in every military capacity. And he pumped up, but we never were. In all this time, these 70 years since the Cold War, we were always ahead. But we were always the underdog in our own mind. So Central America, in Reagan's mind, becomes the bulwark of communism in this country. We're being threatened again. They're coming in. The Sandinistas in Nicaragua are very dangerous to the underbelly of Texas and Arizona. They're going to come up. He's worried about Guatemala. He's worried about Honduras going red, and Salvador, very important. So he starts basically a dirty war in these Central American countries. I was there. That's when I went back to the East. I made a film called Salvador and hung out, and I saw soldiers. It reminded me of my own experience in Vietnam, young soldiers in the streets of Tegucigalpa, walking around lost, white skin and all that, and saying, what are you doing here? You know, they don't know. And I asked them, do you remember Vietnam? And they shrugged. They said, not really. We don't know much about it. We don't want to discuss it, sir. So it was a death squads, terror. The right-wing parties of Central America took their nod from Reagan and killed a lot of. In Guatemala, it was the bloodiest, but certainly in Nicaragua, the Contra War was a dirty war.
And of course, you went back years later and told the story of the changing Latin America, right? As you went country by country,
the borders many years later. Yes. Yeah, that's the 1990s. That comes out of the economics of Reagan. The South America is decimated by the. Really, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank play a huge role. And the people turn against it. These are democratically elected new leaders in the 21st century. They came in because of the disastrous policies of Reagan.
I wanted to get to President Obama before the end of this conversation. In the last chapter of your book, The Untold History of the United States, it's called Obama, Managing a Wounded Empire, Oliver Stone.
Yeah, no, it's a...
You're fiercely critical of him, but you also supported him.
I supported him because the alternative was more frightening. It's a limited choice that Americans have. We live inside now no longer a national security state. I think it's a global security state. Obama has made it very clear, as did Romney, that it's about American power. We are the, quote, indispensable nation in the world, which is a form of American exceptionalism. And he made it very clear that he is going to take troops and so forth out of Afghanistan and Iraq, but he's committing on a full-spectrum dominance to a containment of China. He said it. Hillary Clinton has said the 21st century will be America's Pacific century, which is a version, an echo of Henry Luce's statement. So it doesn't end, and you'll see Obama, I think, is going to move, making alliances, treaties with countries all around the world. He's already expanding the Bush version of security. You know about the terror state. I guess you have done shows about. He hasn't gone back on any of the civil liberty laws. Peter, you want to add something?
And he's expanded it. I mean, we were so critical of Bush for doing surveillance against people without judicial review. Obama's targeting and killing people without judicial review. We're acting as judge, jury, and executioner now.
This is President Obama on the secret drug war on CNN, a drone war.
It has to be a target that is authorized by our laws. It has to be a threat that is serious and not speculative. It has to be a situation in which we can't capture the individual before they move forward on some sort of operational plot against the United States. And this is an example of where I think there's been some misreporting. Our preference is always to capture if we can, because we can gather intelligence. But a lot of the terrorist networks that target the United States, the most dangerous ones, operate in very remote regions, and it's very difficult to capture them. And we've got to make sure that in whatever operations we conduct, we are very careful about avoiding civilian casualties.
There is President Obama speaking. We only have a minute left, but I was just thinking about the Yemeni cleric Alaki's 16-year-old son, who was killed, Abdurrahman Alaki, 2 weeks after his father was killed, also in a drone strike.
Human beings is one. People will hate us more for doing this, and we're invading the sovereignty of Pakistan and Yemen and so many countries. I mean, the United States is acting with impunity, but the bigger issue is simply that there has been never, in the history of empires, and they've all fallen, no one has a monopoly on any weapon ever. And whether it's the atomic bomb, it's copied, or the hydrogen bomb, or in this case, Predator drones will be made by other people, and they will be coming this way or to our base. We have 800 bases around the world under this empire that we've created. So we're very vulnerable, and also we've created hatred.
And it doesn't work. That's the other point, that when we started our drone attacks in Yemen, there were 300 members of al-Qaeda there. Now there are 700 or 800 members. It backfires, these policies. We just make people hate us. We refer to the CIA operators who target people in Pakistan, refer to them as bug splats, people who are killed there. To the Pakistanis, those are human beings. To the operators here are their bug splats, and that's the attitude.
We have to get some comprehensive peace plan going. We have to join the rest of the world, and we have to be part of the United Nations, not an outlier, and that's where we...
Well,
you're finished. I'm finished.
Three-time Oscar award-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone
thank
and
you,
historian
Andy.
Peter Kuznick, I want to thank you both for being with us. Their book, The Untold History of the United States, their 10-part miniseries on Showtime is Monday evenings. We will link to it at democracynow.org.
Thank you for listening to the Mindenki Yoga Radio Show. You can always find us online at lmv.hu/MINDENKIJOGA. You can also find us on Facebook. Just type in Mindenki Yoga. You can also find us on Google+. And send us email. We love email. We love all email, good or bad. We love suggestions, anything at all. Send us email at mindenkiyoga@mailbox.hu. Thank you for listening, and talk to you again this coming week.